In the matter of Barry Moran, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Deputy Ethics Counsel Ho Chin Kim for the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Robin M. Hill for the respondent, Barry Barron, who is also present.
Mr. Barron, you'll have the opportunity, if you like, to address the court
after counsel conclude their arguments, and you can speak with Ms. Hill beforehand if you'd like to consult. Ms. Kim, please go ahead. I'd ask everybody else to mute themselves.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Court. In these attorney disciplinary matters, the Office of Attorney Ethics requests the court to adopt the decisions and recommendations of the Disciplinary Review Board that recommended that respondent Barry J. Barron be disbarred. We rely upon the board's decisions that detail the majority's rationales in applying progressive discipline to determine disbarment is the appropriate sanction in both disciplinary matters. As to the first matter, which was on a 6-3 recommendation for disbarment, it stemmed from a District 4 investigation on a default record, a certification of the record. And the board noted Mr. Barron's extensive disciplinary history, inclusive of two prior default matters, such that even when Mr. Barron filed a motion to vacate his default, he failed to provide a meritorious defense, as well as good cause as to why he did not file an answer to District 4's complaints. Based upon his extensive history, including his continuing failure to abide by the ethics system's rules, the board recommended disbarment. And the second matter brought by the Office of Attorney Ethics against Mr. Barron, the board again noted Mr. Barron's disciplinary history, which included repeated record-keeping violations, despite having been on notice since his first sanction for negligent misappropriation back in 2004. He then was sanctioned again for negligent misappropriation, record-keeping violations in 2016, and again in 2018. In other words, Mr. Barron failed to rectify his conduct with respect to handling funds for his clients and for his own law practice and the record-keeping role since 2003, when the OAE first made him aware of his obligations. At the review board, the OAE recommended a 3-year suspension rather than disbarment, but noted that that recommendation was in consideration of Mr. Barron's history only and not have taken into consideration the board's prior disbarment recommendation. As we are here today, it is the OAE's recommendation based upon Mr. Barron's extensive history, and noting that these are the 8th and 9th matters before this court, such that disbarment is the appropriate sanction.
Questions, anyone for Ms. Kim? Ms. Kim, would you care to address the argument that Ms. Hill raised, that had these matters been considered together, we would not be at the disbarment stage at this time?
I believe the argument that the board overstepped in applying progressive discipline in its first disbarment recommendation was addressed by the OAE in its papers, but because of the nature, the default nature of the district matter that resulted in the board's first disbarment recommendation, that argument is not persuasive. If Mr. Barron had filed an answer to the District 4 Ethics Committee's complaint, engaged in a hearing, and then argued for something short of disbarment because the underlying misconduct was around the same time frame as his prior history, that might have resulted in a different sanction recommendation. But that is not what occurred here at the board. Again, it was a default. And so because it was the third default before the board, in recommending disbarment, the board included not only the underlying misconduct, but also the fact that Mr. Barron was not able to conform his conduct and have learned from the past as to how the ethics system works in New Jersey. And so the disbarment recommendation from the board in the eighth matter is appropriate. And even if it were not, the ninth matter before this court, which is what the OAE charged or is the OAE matter before this court. Again, it was a record-keeping matter with negligent misappropriation, but it was the fourth such matter brought against Mr. Barron, which again, I think proves the board's point that Mr. Barron just cannot conform his conduct. He has proved that he is not learning and cannot become compliant with the rules of professional conduct or the court's record-keeping rule. So to answer you, Chief Justice, I do believe the board's decisions explain their rationale such that even in New Jersey's progressive discipline scheme, disbarment is still the appropriate sanction.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. Ms. Hill.
I would like to note that initially that the OAE contended in its brief that but for the audit in what is docketed as D12920, the second matter, the clients would never have received the money to which they were entitled. That is, in fact, not accurate at all. In fact, all of the clients received the funds to which they were entitled at the time the funds were distributed. What actually happened here is that first in Pearson, Mr. Barron overpaid Pearson and did not take approximately $2,000 in fees to which he was entitled. In addition, this conduct all occurred prior to the first suspension in 2018, a three-month suspension. When he was notified of the suspension, he reviewed the rule and the order and unfortunately distributed the funds in his account without paying appropriate attention to the details of each of the subaccounts. He was then holding funds for to be paid in two cases, one for potential medical expenses and the second for potential medical liens. He reviewed his account. He found the error. He replaced the funds prior to the audit. I mean, it's relevant in terms of what his intent was and the level of care that he did take at that point. There are two recommendations before you, both for disbarment, and I certainly would address each of them separately. But for both cases, the record does not support either the specific findings by the board, the governing legal precedent, or the proper reading of Mr. Barron's disciplinary history in concert with the theory of progressive discipline. These aspects do not support a recommendation for disbarment either individually or together. And I say this because, first, the recommended discipline of disbarment is excessive even when Mr. Barron's disciplinary history is reviewed. It's true that he defaulted three times. It's true also that he has a total of four record-keeping cases that have come before this court. However, if you look at the cases individually, it's clear that these cases do not comport with prior cases where only suspensions or lesser discipline have been applied in similar circumstances. One of the most important aspects of the defense here is that the concept of progressive discipline has been misapplied. And I say that because all of the rule violations in Harvey occurred prior to the six-month suspension that was imposed in three client matters in 2020, I believe. Harvey's conduct, the representation of Harvey occurred between 2016 and 2017. He was disciplined for three similar events during the same period of time in 2020. It was simply physically impossible to go back and cure Harvey prior to the matter coming to the attention of the disciplinary system. I believe her complaint was not, her grievance was not filed until 2018. In addition, the conduct with regard to the record keeping and negligent misappropriation occurred prior to the 2018 suspension, the three-month suspension in 2018 for record-keeping violations. And as I indicated, when he learned of the suspension, he distributed the balance in his trust account in order to bring that balance to zero, which of course is required as part of the rules that apply subsequent to suspension. Unfortunately, he made a mistake in terms of how to distribute that money, and he did rectify that. So all of the record-keeping errors really occurred prior to that, the time of the suspension, and it was his follow-through applying those same types of record-keeping mistakes that led to the funds being distributed and led to him replacing those funds. The concept of progressive discipline stems from labor employment law issues. And in the employment law context, an employee is first brought up on charges or advised that his conduct was inappropriate. And once he's learned that the conduct is inappropriate, if he goes back and then commits the same misconduct and comes before his employer again, the concept of progressive discipline requires that the discipline be increased. So if he's had a warning already, he would get some type of further discipline. If he's been suspended from the job for a period of time, the discipline would then be enhanced. It would be higher, above what would normally apply in that specific circumstance. Progressive discipline presupposes that the employee has the opportunity to revise his behavior. So obviously, if the conduct occurred prior to the imposition of discipline, there is no warning, and there can't be an expectation that the employee could have changed his behavior as a result of that discipline. The board has reflected that rationale in the Cook decision, and I cited to it in my brief. That's a 2018 case where they determined not to apply progressive discipline, and they stated, we do not consider respondent's prior admonition as an aggravating factor in this case. Although the unethical conduct under scrutiny here is similar, and that was a lack of diligence and failure to communicate case, it predates the imposition of discipline in the admonition matter. Accordingly, it cannot be said that respondent failed to learn from past mistakes and that progressive discipline requires enhancement of the discipline to be imposed. And both in Harvey and the negligent misappropriation matter under review today, there was no opportunity to learn from past mistakes following related prior discipline. The three-month suspension specifically for record keeping and the six-month suspension in 2020 for the three cases in 2015, 16, and 17 that were based on failure to communicate and lack of diligence.
Ms. Hill? Yes. So this case involves not simply the argument that you're advancing of not having learned from mistakes, but defaulting, ignoring, failing to cooperate with on multiple occasions to a level that the court has not seen, has seldom seen. How should that be accounted for?
Well, I would respectfully disagree that the court has not seen this before. There have been
seldom seen, but I'm not so much looking at precedent. I'm trying to figure out what happened in this case in terms of how we should weigh that.
Well, I believe that while Mr. Barron did default in three matters, and in the Harvey matter here in particular, his conduct subsequent to that reflects that he has learned from his mistakes. And, you know, I've seen a lot of ethics matters in my career, which I can't believe is as long as it is, but it's not at all unusual for an attorney respondent to take what we used to call the ostrich approach and bury his head in the sand and think that things might go away. Obviously, you like to think that once an attorney's disciplined, he or she would then react appropriately and file the appropriate answer and participate in the hearing. And you asked me really two separate issues. You asked me about a default and a failure to cooperate, because Mr. Barron did cooperate fully in the 129-20 case, the record keeping and negligent misappropriation case that is one of the two matters before you today. He also has hired an accounting firm and gone through every aspect of record keeping and intends to, should he be reinstated at some point in the future, which he certainly hopes will occur, he intends to utilize that firm to assist him in maintaining his books and records properly. With regard to the failure to cooperate aspect of the charge of 8.1B in the 129-20 case, the record-keeping case, he did cooperate in that case with the Office of Attorney Ethics, with the exception of one question that was tied to assessment of costs in two of the seven underlying matters. In that case, there was, I believe, costs that Mr. Barron had charged back to Pearson of $125 and to his client Lynch, I think it was $255. He had actually ballparked those costs and undercut his actual costs. He had looked for the support for that. He could not find it in a timely fashion and didn't respond, admittedly, to the OAE on that particular issue. He responded on all other issues related to those seven record-keeping matters. And with regard to those two items, he did end up returning the funds to Pearson and attempted to return the funds to Lynch, who had unfortunately died and is in the process of sending the money to Lynch's sister. He's been waiting for some type of estate to be formally, go through probate, and apparently nothing has happened. So it is a small portion of the case as a whole. And he did, in fact, respond to the specific charge of an 8.1B violation in his answer to the ethics complaint. And he did file that answer timely. So, and with regard to the other cases, he cooperated to a degree in the case that resulted in the 6-month suspension in 2020. He responded to two of the three inquiries. He filed an answer in Harvey. The answer was unfortunately late, and it was not filed until 3 weeks after the default was forwarded to the Office of Attorney Ethics. And in all three default matters, he had attempted to overturn the defaults by filing motions to vacate, which were denied. But the most recent conduct shows that he has learned, I believe, from his mistakes. He was cooperating. He values his license. He certainly has attempted to comply fully in this last matter. And I believe what also happened here is that there was simply a cascade of ethics matters and requests for information. He was also impacted by COVID. He had closed his office in early March. May not have received all the information since he did not go back to his office after that point in time. And, again, I think with the earlier default, There is certainly the aspect of the ostrich approach, which he has assured me that is a thing of the past at this point. Does that address your question, Chief Justice?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, okay. So the other aspect that I'd like to note here is that there are a number of default cases where individuals have defaulted as much as six times and not been disbarred. And I would refer you particularly to the Kozlowski matter that was cited in my brief. In that case, the I believe they were the seventh and eighth matters to be reviewed by this court. The attorney had defaulted, and the cases came up on a consecutive basis. A companion case to the original case were before the court at the same time. And when the court reviewed it, the determination was made to impose a two-year suspension with a consecutive one-year suspension. Kozlowski's conduct was extensive and included a private reprimand, an admonition, three reprimands, a three-month suspension, a one-year suspension, and then the two-year suspension plus the consecutive one-year that was addressed by this court in 2007. And as I said, there were six matters in which that attorney defaulted. The board had said at that time that Kozlowski's repeated indifference to the ethics system was beyond forbearance, but a suspension was considered adequate by them at that time. And the second matter in that case also involved a lack of diligence, failure to expedite litigation, et cetera. It bears some similarities to the Harvey matter, but in a sense is worse because it also included a violation of 1.15B, a failure to comply with a court order to refund a retainer. If the court is going to look at any particular case in reaching its decision in this matter, that certainly is a very relevant matter to look at. There are other cases like the Wright case and the Swidler case, where the attorney had defaulted four times, and they were disciplined, and the default was considered in ratcheting up the discipline. I would note, however, that in Mr. Barron's situation, he went from, I believe it was a reprimand, a censure, another censure, then 3 months, 6 months, and in the Correa matter, which was imposed in 2020, as was the six-month matter suspension, the discipline jumped from a six-month suspension to a three-year suspension based on progressive discipline, and yet that case involved one client matter of a lack of diligence and failure to communicate with the client. And in most instances, even a case like Harvey, as noted by the board in its decision, that type of conduct would merit a reprimand. So,
all of the cases that you've been talking about and the histories, the disciplinary histories of these individuals are talking about the interaction between the lawyer and the client and doing better with communication and handling matters.
Yes.
None of them seem to really reflect repeated instances of negligent misappropriation, which we do have here, starting in 2004. And then the long gap with other kinds of infractions until we reached the spate of activity that took place in the mid-2010s, leading up to the end of that decade, and hence these disbarment actions. Mm-hmm. And my question to you as an experienced attorney in this area is, isn't this something of a different type that we're talking about? How many times does somebody... is an attorney that we allow to practice and supposedly take care with the funds owed to clients, get to repeatedly make these same kinds of mistakes and be entitled to progressive discipline?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there actually are cases, Justice LaVecchia, where there has been repeated negligent misappropriation and repeated discipline for other cases of misconduct. If you look at Zonies, which is a 2019 matter, Zonies was suspended for a three-month period, and it was the fifth time that Zonies had been disciplined, and the prior four matters included two cases of record-keeping infractions. So, you know, it is not unusual, especially where the negligent misappropriation has been what I would call
And what kind of mitigation was presented there? Because here we're not hearing mental illness or some kind of abuse problem. We're in fact getting defaults, no explanation for this repeated activity.
Right. And again, there have been many cases where there has been repeated default, and Kozlowski, I believe, also included record keeping issues and six defaults. So, you know, there are no, obviously disciplinary matters are considered on a case by case basis.
Of course.
Is no identical matter, but the position is that clients were not harmed as a result of the negligent misappropriation. As demonstrated in this matter, none of them lost any money, even on a temporary basis. One actually got more money than that to which he was entitled. And, you know, it was rectified. So I see these initially as the record keeping violations are really a failure to comply with the specifics, not maintaining receipts and disbursements journal, not making the proper records in the individual ledger cards. Mm-hmm. All of those matters led to the negligent misappropriation, but did not cause a loss of funds directly to the clients. I think that's extremely relevant.
And does your response to my question change at all when we consider at what point in one's career one is making these repetitive mistakes? This is not a brand new attorney starting out in practice, but someone who's been out there for some time.
Well, that's correct. But I do think that the fact that he had an unblemished record for 23 years should be considered in his favor, certainly. I think that the initial misconduct that occurred beginning in 2004 up to and including 2016 was fairly minor in terms of the level of discipline that was imposed. And progressive discipline was imposed, as I recollect, in the censure matter that dealt with record keeping. So each one of those cases has been ratcheted up because of the prior misconduct. And I guess the question is, when do you stop ratcheting it? You know, when do you just look at the conduct and say, okay, this is a repeat, you're not listening to us, we don't want you to practice law anymore because we considered you to be a danger to the public. And what I'm saying here is that this conduct predated the more serious suspension that occurred in 2018, and at that point, subsequent to discovery of the problem, he then proceeded to go to an accountant who handles a lot of attorney accounts and knows the specifics. And he has advised that he will, in the future, act according to that. The other thing is that he has indicated to me that when he returns to practice, he's in his 60s, that he would do so on a part-time basis. But this is a profession that he loves. He has helped many people. I believe that the problems stemmed from too much work. He took on a number of significant pro bono bankruptcies he just couldn't complete all the work. And that led to a lot of the issues. Having been a sole practitioner, I can say it is very difficult to follow through and comply with all of the records, and you need help. You need to reach out to have somebody help you take care of the many requirements that occur, especially with regard to your attorney books and records. If you don't have someone in the office handling it, you need to get an outside source. That, I believe, he has resolved that issue. And has it taken a while? Yes, but I don't think from that you can look at his record and say he continually acted out beginning in 2004 when he had his first record-keeping problem. That to me is not what his disciplinary record indicates. And while there have been a number of actions taken against him, he's really shot himself in the foot, because if he had come forward and defended the cases, he might likely have had a very good defense in the matters that came forward as defaults. So if you look at the type of cases that this court has reviewed and you go back to when the conduct occurred and the fact that he's already in a 3-month suspension for similar conduct, a 3-year suspension, I apologize, for similar conduct, as well as that the discipline jumps from a 6-month suspension to a 3-year suspension, in this matter, it would be appropriate to limit the discipline imposed to a concurrent 3-year suspension. And if that were to occur, I believe that the court would still be complying with the purposes of discipline, which would be to protect the public and also to ensure that the profession is given its due. But it would also allow Mr. Barron to continue to practice a profession that he loves. And certainly it would not be inappropriate to, if the court felt it necessary, to impose certain conditions on his reinstatement. That was one of the things that was initially addressed by the Office of Attorney Ethics when they were prosecuting this case, to submit reconciliations monthly or quarterly and have review of his accounts.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Do you know, does Thank Mr. You. Barron wish to address the court? Would you like to speak with him privately? Yes. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Being a lawyer has always given me a great sense of pride and personal satisfaction. Over the years, since 1981, when I started practicing, I believe that I've made a real difference with a lot of people and made their lives better. I started practicing bankruptcy work in large part in about 20 years ago. I saw that I could clearly improve people's lives, and there were often times where after bankruptcy, someone would come to me and let me know that they'd had a 700 credit rating or that they were able to purchase a home for their family, and that always gave me a great satisfaction. I often did bankruptcy work in pro bono, as Ms. Hill has alluded to. I have been devastated by my recent suspensions. In recent years, I've accomplished a lot, but I also recognize that I've let down certain of my clients and my family and myself, and that's something which I never thought would happen to me. I very much realized that by not properly handling everything that I had been taking on, that many things that needed proper attention were indeed causing problems for my clients, and I deeply regret that every single day. I've tried to use my suspensions as best I could. I've taken many CLE courses over the past year and a half, and I also volunteer transportation services for seniors. The time away that I've had from my practice has made me reflect a lot. I firmly believe that I've regained the sense of purpose that I had before, with a clear understanding of what needs to be done in every case and what must be done in every case. If given the chance, I know that I can again demonstrate a renewed dedication to my practice and give a sustained effort in a much better way in any case that I would accept. I hope and I pray that I get that opportunity again. I feel terrible that I've damaged something very precious, which is my law license, and that I've caused harm to my clients and my family and myself. I desperately do want to keep my law license, and if I am ever again given the chance to do so, I would never repeat the mistakes that I've made in the past. I know that I can do better and that I will do better for all of my work and the clients that I would have. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Mr. Barron, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
Knowing the disciplinary process, its seriousness and its consequences, as you did from multiple experiences, can you tell us why you defaulted on multiple occasions after that?
Yes, well, I can try. I can say that my sense as to when I defaulted, not that it's excused, but that they involved fee arbitrations, and that I had intended to repay the clients when I was ordered to do so or before that, which I did do in every instance. So I did try to comply very hard and not default in any matter other than what were fee arbitrations, which involved Correa and Harvey, Tinsley, and Tinsley was pro bono. But the reason for, I think, the vast majority of any defaults had to do with fee arbitrations, which I regret, and which I stupidly thought I would be able to rectify once I was ordered by the fee arbitration board to repay the client's money. So those are many instances in which I had done significant amount of work with those clients, but did wind up repaying everything that they had paid to me for their bankruptcies. So.
But your default in the ethics matters, not the fee matters.
Once right. An ethics complaint. Right. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, and I did default in certain ethics matters by, I suppose, which I did try to file motions to set aside the defaults, which I had not yet thought were completely entered, and which I would have hoped I would have been able to enter appearances to explain those matters. So I sincerely apologize, and I really didn't understand the full import of what I had been neglecting when it came to things which I needed to address.
Thank you. Other questions, anyone?
We'll take the matter under advisement.